G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 312.
Bing, bing.
Bing, bing, bong, bong, bing, bing, bing.
The bing, bing, bang, bang, boom. I was imitating puppets, and I said, maybe I shouldn't do that anymore.
Bye, bing.
Bing, that's the end of that. You know, it's the only thing he can say.
Bing, bing.
Too soon, Donald. The election's not till next year. Now get back in your box. Now, back to where we were up to. My name's Dick Newman. I think that's it. Let's get on with it.
What the fuck?
Yeah, look, I think I just want to move on with some history. So we finished up last time with that election. Nice big Whig majority once again. Improved Whig majority, I should say. Now, while the election had been going on, government stopped. No, it didn't. Of course it doesn't, my dear listener. It never does. Government keeps going for you 24/7, 365. Elections are just a nice time for public servants with their political masters out looking for votes. Those hard-working public servants can finally get some work done. That's how they see it. Foreign affairs certainly do not shut down ever. So if we want to pause and review, we would find that over the last generation or two or three, we've been allied to what we might call the Germanic types. The headline has been the Empire of the Sausages and the Duchies. Once the Tories said enough of this shitty war and created a peace, the guys with the brains saw that the biggest advantage to us commercially lay with the Frenchies. Sure, our new king is a Germanic type, but we really just need a non-aggro type deal with the Germanic states, and then we can push on with France for our future. While Paul has by now got some able guys around Europe to keep him informed of what is going on, foreign affairs is still his weak point, but he is more than interested in it. He has to be. It's a big part of the job. Turnip has been the foreign policy part of the dynamic duo, and we might find Turnip as a typical English-speaking foreign affairs type. That is, paranoid. Oh, you don't just believe me, my dear listener. Have a crack at the current top US foreign affairs guy, Anthony Blinken. Now, he's supposed to be a diplomat talking about peace, but yeah, he will cheerfully tell you about the 1,001 very serious threats to our magnificent freedom and democracy. Well, just listen to the guys before him. Trump's several appointees and crooked Hillary Clinton can tell you all about the threats, and sleepy Joe never ever met a war he didn't like. I'm getting off track. But it seems that the English-speaking countries are all a bit bloody paranoid that everyone else wants to come here and take all our stuff because we're the most magnificent, so, yeah, they're all jealous of us. Yeah, they're not. Mostly, though, everyone else would be happy if we just left them the fuck alone. But catching up on where we got to. It's easier to get paranoid back in the day because we can get upset when two kiddies get married, particularly if one of those kiddies is going to be Louis XV. He'd been betrothed to that Spanish cousin for a bit, which you might recall. It all looked too much like that would create some major war. So Louis dumped the Infanta. Instead, he married that Maria. You know, I don't think I said her name last time. And I'm looking at her last name now and saying, can I say that? Lezuzuzuneska. That's what I'm going with. Lezuzuzuneska, daughter of the pretender to the throne of Poland. And now that's got Spain totally pissed off, or at least it pissed off Elizabeth Farnese, mother of the dumped Infanta. She will then get onto the team a Dutchy weirdo, Jan Willem Ripperda, who just kind of turned up in Spain saying, I'm a freelance diplomat. Yeah, that's all right, isn't it? Jan Willem will be off to the Emperor Sausage saying, hey, big guy, Spain wants to be BFFs, like big-time real BFFs with a full-on alliance. Signed treaty full deal. Oh, sounds good, says the sausage. You guys still got tons of cash because that's what I need. Well, he probably didn't say it that way, but Spain's got the reputation of constant gold coming in and the Empire has the reputation of being too broke to shout a pizza for the party and so always wanting that gold and the deal will be done and Spain is to deliver gold to the Empire, which won't happen. The other thing you might want to understand in this is that not all kings are enlightened like our German Georges. For example, Spain fondly remember the good old days of telling Jews and Muslims to go back where they came from. Coming here, taking our jobs. Well, no, not really. It was about their stupid bloody religion, Abrahamic faith stuff. Well, we are too, but yeah, wrong Abrahamic faith stuff. And then they would set fire to anyone who was a bit slow to leave. Now you've got the English operating in the Spanish sphere of influence doing deals with Muslims in Morocco and Algiers. Yeah, we're actually dealing with bloody Muslims and saying, hey, Jews, you can come back to England and you can live in our territory of Gibraltar if you like. Oh, fuck, that's just across the bloody water from Spain. For the English, it's just business, but for the Spanish, it's really annoying. Bloody Jews back. I want the whole world to be nicely prejudiced Christians, just like the Spanish are. The two guys, Walpole and Fleury, that's the guy in France, both thought all this stuff was just a bit silly. You just keep doing business, nice and quietly. You get rich, you avoid wars. Turnip Townsend, though, is seeing doom and gloom. It's Spain and the Empire, they're going to make an alliance. This is going to be the end of Europe as we know it. He's writing to people saying he can see one huge empire that will snatch up France and then we'll all be just stuffed. And look at those Spanish royals are pretty sickly, so if they die, then France will snatch up Spain and then the Empire and then we're all in the same boat. There's an English novel, my dear listener, called Cold Comfort Farm, which you should read or watch a movie. They made a movie about 30 years ago. In this novel, there is a character, Great Aunt Ada Doom, who went down to the woodshed and saw something nasty, and she was never the same again. And Turnip's a bit like Aunt Ada Doom. He has seen in his mind's eye a very unhappy future for us all. Oh, it's doom and gloom, my dear listener. Turnip then will look to put together his alliance, which is the Alliance of Hanover. Terrible idea because it comes at a cost. Some things don't change, so a modern-day example would be NATO. If your country wants to be in the NATO club, then a condition of membership is that you must spend X dollars on bangy stuff and not, say, housing for the homeless or medical care for your citizens or education. No, you've got to spend it on bangy stuff. Ho, says your country, where can I buy this bangy stuff? Well, right here in the USA, of course. Back then, for European countries, it was declared for either Team Empire / Spain or Team England / France. Tensions ramp up. We expect to see warships in strategic locations, and on it goes being escalated, and suddenly Russia invades Ukraine, and we can all say, well, we never saw that coming. No, what a total and utter surprise. Oh, if I come back in a modern day, yeah, it was a total shock surprise. Nobody saw that coming. Of course, it wasn't a bloody surprise. We'll have to say we were surprised because we also want to say it was nothing to do with us. No, nothing to do with us. We're the sweet, innocent defenders of freedom and democracy. We're the good guys. Oh dear, I'm starting to rave. Okay, history, and I'll stay on track. We then have lots of stuff to deal with internationally back then, with the Hanover Treaty, and it's not all fun and giggles at home either. Oddly enough, it's not just me who thinks that this is costly and a provocative action that should not have happened. Walpole will kick off by defending Turnip, but then we start looking for Sweden and Denmark to join Team Us, and shit, how much will that cost? Walpole is having to say the opposite of lots of stuff he'd previously said. The opposition are having their fun with our employment of Hessian mercenaries, and then, oh dear, Walpole has to talk up having a standing army. That is the absolute opposite of Whig policy. And sadly, when Walpole just comes up with the name Land Army as, oh, it's a totally different thing to a standing army, well then, we start to think, have you gone Sleepy Joe on us? It just happens to look and work exactly the same, says Walpole, but it's a totally different thing. Back to our alliances and rising tensions, and of course we will absolutely, positively have an incident. How can we not? It is one thing for the big swinging dicks to have their meetings with tea and ice vovos and PowerPoint presentations and big talk, but it's another thing to try and control all the hundreds and thousands of things that just happen all over the place. And so, welcome to the war of Jenkins' ear. Yeah, that's that thing on the side of your head that you can listen with. Jenkins was a captain of the brig, Rebecca. That's the name of the brig, sorry, Rebecca. He's operating around the Caribbean. Oh, that's nice. That's lovely. Until some Spanish authorities come in for a routine check for contraband. Now, who knows what happened? Not me. Perhaps Jenkins was being a total dick, deciding to give the Spaniards a hard time. But look, here comes his ear off, thanks to the Spaniards, and it's to be...
What the fuck?
Yeah, well, obviously, what the fuck, dude. But really, it's to be...
What is he good for?
Absolutely nothing.
Damn Spaniards taking our captain's ear off. We can't let them get away with that. Before you know it, they'll be here to rape our sons. Now, the Spanish do not call this the War of Jenkins' Ear, not at all. The Spanish call it the Guerra del Asiento. Asiento refers to our contract with them regarding the taking and sale of human beings with black skin. Make up your own mind, as usual, my dear listener. Is it about the ear, or is it about selling black people? Don't tell me yet, more information to come. Will around 50,000 English die over some bloke's ear? Or over a filthy trade worth lots and lots of cash? You're leaning towards Team Spaniard on the matter of what this war is about? But if you're not totally convinced, let me just tell you, the ear will come off and the war starts 9 years later. 9 years. With the English saying, yeah, it is all about the ear. Oh, bullshit. Walpole is now the commander of English forces. Just the opposite of what he wanted. But at least we've got all those lovely allies. Well, our allies give zero fucks about Jenkins or his ear or his dick and balls for that matter. There's nothing in this for them with the human trafficking trade, so Poms, you're on your own. Yeah, so much for fancy signatures on fancy alliance documents. Let's have some speechifying at the House of Lords. No, let's not. Let's just have the headline. It's a Jacobite plot. Oh, God almighty. Of course it's a Jacobite plot. In comes Pulteney demanding a committee of inquiry into public debts. Oh, that's nice. It'll take our minds off everything. Shit, this guy wants to know the current state of the deficit. And unlike the US today, we can't just go to the US debt clock on the internet and watch those numbers spin like crazy. 32 trillion if you're wondering what their debt is today. Debt per citizen, 95,628, or debt per taxpayer, $249,403. Good luck, America. But no resources like that for Pulteney, and handy for guys like Walpole, who may like it that people don't know what the total government debt is. Walpole will certainly huff and puff about it. Preposterous idea and dangerous given the state of play in Europe. We need confidence in public credit. Pulteney said he only wanted to give Walpole the chance to show the public his integrity. Just show him the numbers, Walpole, and everybody will know that you are a brilliant manager of money. Lovely, says Walpole. Then we'll do it when you're in charge of the cash, mate. So we'll be showing you off instead of me. Walpole will defeat the thing with a vote of 285 to 107. Perhaps we should explore what is now becoming the unhappy relationship between Walpole and Turnip. The great double act was in trouble, and it's probably down to their both having their own view of who was the big threat. We know that Walpole is totally scared of Jacobites. Yeah, he is. He is bloody paranoid about Jacobites, but who else cares? Turner, on the other hand, was totally scared of the Empire. Why the fuck he's scared of the Empire is about as smart as why is Walpole scared of the Jacobites. Turnip seems to have thought the current Emperor Chuck was our old super sausage Chuck who was running most of Europe and half of America. But no, they're two totally different Chucks, and the current Chuck is like the more recent emperors. He's struggling for cash. He's not a threat. He doesn't have resources. But Turnip failed to see it, which is why we hired Hessian mercenaries for a bit and why we were moving warships around the place, and those things gave the opposition plenty of ammunition to fire us. We'll kind of get over that, and then it's back to the Frenchy fortifications in the lowland that still haven't been demolished. So it'll be Turnip on the case. And the Frenchies will be very good at playing the game. I have no authorization to do this. Or if you turn up for an appointment with some Frenchy official, he'll say, I am sorry, I have no idea why you are here. Nobody told me that you would be visiting. Can it be worse, and what do you reckon? Inspections reveal the Frenchies are constructing new sluices in contravention to the treaty. They're supposed to be winding down, but they're ramping up and nobody knows anything about it. A couple of years go by with the English demanding demolition and the Frenchies doing nothing. The opposition are having great laughs over this, and there needs to be a loser. And Turnip is looking like a loser. He'd stuffed up with the South Sea bubble, and he went alarmist about the Empire, and with his advice taken, we spent too much money on a nothing event. There's been pretty much zero gains internationally, and the Frenchies are obviously laughing at us too. 1730, and Turnip will resign. The partnership is over. England can conclude a treaty with the Emperor Sausage, and Turnip can invent the Norfolk four-course system. That is, crop rotation. Turnips, barley, clover and wheat. He'll die in 8 years, age 64.
Oh, where's the need me? Where's the feed me when I'm 64?
No, Turnip, but you will get a nice coffin, so there is that. It was fair enough that Turnip went. At the time that he did go, he was drumming up anti-empire stuff, which would have put us on Team Spain and against everybody else. With Turnip no longer there to push that policy, we can be on Team Empire with Spain isolated, and that's just how we want Spain to be. We can now go and kick them over some guy's ear and end up with the slave trade. In other news, German George is dead. Well, that's the other news in Rome, where it's finally got to. And so the pretender now knows that German George is dead, and he can run round and round in circles. Big circles, looking for guys to rise in rebellion against the Germanic oppressor and get his glorious and righteous and God-approved bum on the big chair. Yeah, nobody's up for a Jacobite rising just now. Thanks all the same, James. So James has been away trying to get guys to rise in rebellion, and while the James was away, the Clementina did kind of play. Well, not what I might call play. She'll make a slow trip to visit Rome, stopping at every magic show theatre along the way for a good boo-hoo-hoo in front of the baby Jesus torture death statues they like to hang on their walls. Then she'll be in to see her two dear darling lads for some more boo-hoo-hooing and religious fanatic type chats. That sort of stuff's not good for growing boys. Now Prince Charles by now is being all bonny. Oh, Bonnie, we could call him Bonnie Charlie. That is, he is rather pretty. He's got a fair complexion, dark flashing eyes, and totally charming. Yes, very bonny indeed. He is Mum's boy. When he is up, he is way, way up. Yeah, he's on a high. And when he's down, he is deeply depressed. Yeah, big highs and big lows, big swings, like his mum. He can already speak English, Frenchy, and Italian. He's a very good musician. He can ride, he can shoot, he's good at sport. He's a big old show-off, and the Jacobites just love him to bits. But his governors have zero control over him, and that might be down to they're the wrong guys to be his governors, and they're trying to teach him the wrong way. These are serious dour men who want that kiddie to be sitting at a desk doing some serious book learning. Now, this kid is really bright and really active. The absolute last thing he wants to do is sit still and read some boring academic work on some boring subject that he isn't interested in. They managed to teach him to read and write, and they should have perhaps left it at that. But no. So James will be giving the governors boots up the arse, telling them they need to work the boy harder. And that's just bloody hopeless. It won't work at all. What will eventually help is that the younger kiddie Henry will be a decent student. And Charles will want to compete, so he'll start to improve his academic stuff when that kicks in. Apart from that, what we have is the three amigos, Dad James and the lads, Charles and Henry, and they're going to be a tight unit. He'll take them boating or to operas or balls and festivals, and it's all good fun. And they're well-dressed and attractive, and people comment favourably. The English exiles are pleased to see the lads are being brought up as English. They speak English, they dress in English fashions, and as far as possible they eat English food. Charles is certain that his dad is the real deal King of England and that he, Charles, is the definite heir to the big chair. Oh, and look, here comes Clementina back to Rome again, and this time she wants to move back in permanently. The trouble is that while she was away, we developed into the Three Amigos, and, oh, the Three Amigos are fun. Clementina is no longer young and vivacious, and she's only interested in the bloody religion. Oh, boring. So, sure, she can move in, but the Three Amigos don't really care much at all about her. Clementina will spend most of her time in a room, still in a nightie, just praying. If she comes out, then it'll be the full black frock and straight off to Mass to confess all the sins she committed while she was in her room praying to baby Jesus. Even at dinner time, she won't sit at the big table, but sit at a small table on a Pat Malone where she can fast in penance for her mighty sins. Oddly enough, she will start to suffer from malnutrition. Fuck, girl, you're in Rome. Get a pizza in you. Summer, and it's a hot one in Rome. Big Papa Pope will lend the family a nice, cool and breezy palazzo. So off we go, except for Clementina, who will stay behind and suffer for her sins. Oh, bloody religion, isn't it crap? At least Clementina is not sulking or nagging or making scenes like she had previously. Nor will she have any interest in boys' education. Clementina Araroon was just interested in visiting shrines or dashing from magic show to magic show to get in as many masses as possible. As for providing maternal love to her boys, well, yeah, no, not much time for that, nor much inclination. Now, just before we move on, I thought I might mention to you that in Scotland there's been a change in the churchy stuff. In fact, we've moved well away from that Presbyterian stuff of John Knox. It's the Church of Scotland now, which is basically the Anglican Church, and they're in competition with a mob called the Evangelicals. But let's not worry too much about the magical stuff. What I'm interested in is the music, and it's back. And fair enough, look, over in Germany, you've got Bach knocking out hit after hit every Sunday for the Sunday Magic Show. So, of course, the Scotties, being like normal humans, they like a bit of music. They've got music back into the magic show, and well done, Scotties. Now, mind you, can't find you any Scotty composers. Maybe they've just forgotten how to do it. So the big name at the time was a guy, Isaac Watts, who wrote plenty of hymns, and the Scotties loved them.
Joy to the world, the Lord is come. Let earth receive her King. Let every heart prepare him room, and heaven and nature sing. And heaven and nature sing, and heaven and heaven and nature sing.
Joy to the world.
Yeah, that was one of his. Now, while we're catching up on people, let me state the obvious for Henrietta Howard. She is no longer mistress to the prince, she is mistress to the king. Wahoo for Henrietta. It still looks like she has pretty much zero influence on George. Yeah, zero. But that does not stop people thinking she is a power player and treating her as such. Lots of people are coming into Henrietta looking for jobs in the new royal court. There are also letters, like one from Lady Chetwynd, who was worried that her husband's jobs held under German George are now at risk of going to someone else. And, well, they are. There are letters from distant relatives, like Richard Handon, who says he'd been persecuted by Walpole and is now broke and can't even buy a loaf of bread. Oh. If something isn't done, he may be forced to get a job. Oh, how unthinkable, Richard. And sadly for you, mate, Henrietta was on Team Compton. So Walpole might be out for now, but that's only going to be a minute or two and they'll be back. So you, mate, are a bit fucked. So, yes, go and get a job. Here's a better letter from Mrs. Pitt, offering £1,000 if Henrietta can get her brother a gig with the new Prince of Wales. Like Sarah Churchill, Henrietta was one of those rare courtiers who hated bribery, so it was rather a sharp note back. Mrs. Pitt will reply saying, oh, sorry, no offence was meant, and so far as I was concerned, the £1,000 was to be a present, not a bribe. Oh, wasn't that good to be cleared up, my dear listener? And we should apply that to our current times. It's not a bribe if it's a present. Yeah, I'm sure plenty of people do apply that principle right now. And we could look at the Supreme Court of the USA to find that principle operating. This, though, is no fun for our Henrietta. She's besieged with requests and she knows her chances of getting any job emptying the bloody chamber pot is pretty unlikely. Her headaches are back, and that's probably stress. All her friends are saying, hey, great Henrietta, what a fabulous win for you. Well, maybe, but it doesn't bloody well feel like it. Here's Jonathan Swift, turned up in England, writing a lovely letter to Henrietta. What he's interested in is the Chancellor of Dublin Uni gig. He'll return to Ireland disappointed. Henrietta's good buddy, John Gay, got absolutely nothing from German George, so he's now hopeful for a Lord of the Bedchamber to the King. He will be offered Gentleman Usher to two-year-old Princess Louisa, which plays bugger all. That is an insult offer. John Gay will decline and leave the court. Letter from Swift to Gay. I always told you Mrs. Howard was good for nothing but to be a rank courtier. I care not whether she ever writes to me or not. She has cheated us all and may go hang herself. Well, that's a bit harsh. John Gay and others will tell Swift he's wrong and that Henrietta had done what she could. Pope said that lady means to do good and does no harm, which is a big deal for a courtier. I think I can see the hand of Caroline here, making sure Henrietta knows she has no power. Yes, I think that if you're one of these guys, being associated with Henrietta is working against you. And as for Swift, even 6 years later, we'll get this from him to, was it John Gay or Alexander Pope, one of them. I have long hated her on your account, more because you are so forgiving as to not hate her. Dear me, my dear listener, what a damaging and useless emotion this hate thing is. You're better off without it. I'm not going to give you any more of Swift's poison pen letter, which goes on and on. He is very bitter, and it's no way to live your life. Plus, a brief reminder to you, my dear listener, that both Pope and Swift had written sarcastic bits and pieces about Princess Caroline, obviously without thinking that they may want Queen Caroline to help them get a job. Dickheads. Henrietta will be forgiving and continue to try and get Swift a job for 4 years. But this is where Henrietta's patience will wear out. I let her back. You seem to think that you have a natural right to abuse me, because I'm a woman and a courtier. Yeah, she seems to grasp the situation nicely there. I have taken it as a woman and a courtier might, with a great resentment and a determined resolution of revenge. Oh, dear Swift, what have you done? Idiot. But no, even after that harsh sentence, Henrietta will go on, and the letter goes on to try to restore the friendship. Did it work? No. Jonathan Swift will hate Henrietta Howard for the rest of his life because he was a very intelligent and also a very stupid man. John Gay, on the other hand, got over it all very quickly and the two will exchange happy letters for the rest of his life. John Gay wasn't stupid. He knew that Henrietta had tried and failed to get him a job. All he could reasonably expect was that she would try, and she did. So his expectation was fulfilled, and that means that Henrietta had proven her friendship. So let's continue on in happiness. But also, let's think about Henrietta. A change at the top means lots of people get jobs, and lots of people will lose jobs. She needs to be reappointed, and it hasn't happened yet. So Henrietta will stop work on the house at Marble Hill. Oh, and look, here comes more spite from bloody Jonathan Swift. I said I wasn't going to say any more, but anyway. My house was built for a show, my lady's empty pockets know, and now she will not have a shilling to raise the stairs or build the ceiling. It goes on, but we're more interested in Henrietta's role in the silly beheading. Oh, hang on a tick, because something's just dropped in my brain to do with women and voting. I'm pretty sure I made a comment that some women may have the vote by now. So women and voting goes in a big old box called women's suffrage. And that is a very big subject, my dear listener. But What's happening right now is we date this to the start of the women's suffrage, around about where we are. And who knows what triggered it? Perhaps it was the movement of power from monarch to parliament that did it. Anyway, we know that this will kick in with some, and I would think very few, when I say some, very few women will be getting the vote. They'll be big landowners. In about 100 years from now, it will be shitfuckery legislation on the subject of voting, which will define voters as males. So this is that sort of legislation that governments bring in. They're not going to say it's anti-women, but it is pro-male, and just happens to cut women out. And women will not be best pleased about that bit of legislation. Back to Henrietta and the silly behatting, and a reminder that at this stage Henrietta is in limbo. She's a woman of the bedchamber to the princess, which doesn't automatically transfer to the queen. She needs to be appointed to the job again. But turns out she is very good at making the royal frock sparkle. On the day, the first thing that will happen is that Carolyn will be transported to the House of Lords. Her women in the frock had been there since yesterday to be prepared for our new queen. In she goes, and it's the women of the bedchamber that get the battle gear on. This is all going to be a bit tough for Carolyn, because the frock is very bloody heavy, and she's got to walk from the House of Lords to Westminster Abbey. It's just across the road, but still, it's going to be hard work. It will all be worthwhile when we read the reviews. The reviews just go on and on about how magnificent it all was. Now, where was Henrietta in the parade? Well, Carolyn at the top, of course, with her train held by her three eldest daughters. And then we get four women of the Queen's household, one of which is Henrietta. So a top spot, but really those four women are there to make sure that Carolyn's wardrobe malfunctions are dealt with swiftly, if she has them. Henrietta and fellow woman of the bedchamber, Mary Herbert, were noted as having very fine frocks themselves. And Henrietta was appropriately dressed as a king's mistress in scarlet. Everybody else, the last one in is the king. And he's a bit of a letdown after all that lovely bling and whatever. He has what is described as a squat frame, and despite having magnificent whatever clothes, he looks a bit ridiculous. And I reckon if you want to know what a ridiculous king looks like, then just have a look at the footage of the recent silly behatting with Charles III. Like, it needs to be updated somehow, I think. It just looks a bit silly. Worse, of course, George is wandering down the road towards Westminster Abbey, but even though it's October, it turned out to be a rather hot day. George, of course, was wearing ermine, which is very handy if you happen to be in the Arctic Circle, but not much fun on a hot day. George then will move under the canopy that's being carried along, and then people can't see him, and we want to see the king. Worse? Well, yeah, of course it's worse. He's got a crimson velvet hat with ermine lining, also rather warm, and sadly perhaps a bit big. It keeps falling over his eyes. By the time we got to the abbey, George was more than a bit annoyed. Fortunately, the kingly ceremony will go off without a hitch and everyone can have a sigh of relief. Cheers in the abbey triggers the guns to start firing. Sing the Te Deum, and then Carolyn can move up, flanked by those four women of the household. Off comes her velvet cap, and on with a silly hat, and then King and Queen can go and sit in their respective big chairs for the Holy Communion. 3 p.m, back to Westminster Hall, with 300 official guests. The galleries above were open to the public, with people queuing from 4:30 a.m. Yeah, 10 and a half hours of waiting, which did score a place for one Mrs. Pendarves, who later told reporters she had found herself among so violent a crowd that for some minutes I lost my breath, and my cloak, I doubt, for ever. I verily believe I should have been squeezed as flat as a pancake if Providence had not sent Mr. Edward Stanley to my relief. After a great struggle, I managed to secure a good vantage point without any damage other than a few bruises in my arms and the loss of my cloak. Now the crowd will gasp when the special effects team swing into action. Here's the setup. We got all these branches and had them gilded, that is, covered with gold leaf. The golden branches have been suspended from the ceiling. We then put 1,800 candles on these branches, and then for the total wow factor, worked out how to get 1,800 candles lit within about 3 minutes. The effect is a bright golden light radiating out, and the crowd are astonished. After the light, it will be the smell. Yeah, we brought out the roasted meats and their spices. And remember, common smellies have been there for hours and hours, so are unsurprisingly fainting from hunger. The nobles will have much fun putting some tucker in napkins, then hoisting them up using knotted garters. Finally, the party is over, with the royals and nobles retiring. Then the doors get tossed open, and in come the mob for a feed, and just take whatever they can. And whatever they can turns out to be everything. Tablecloths, plates, dishes, cutlery, and after half an hour, there is an empty hall. Yeah, even the tables and chairs have been dismantled and taken too. I guess it's a good way to get your hall cleaned up. Who won't be gasping at the special effects is our new Prince of Wales, Fred. Fred had been the principal mourner for German George's funeral in Leinenschloss, and fair enough. George too and Carolyn were hardly likely to get off their asses to go to his funeral, but they have had 4 months to invite Fred to the silly behatting, and yet did nothing. No, he didn't get an invite. Fred held coronation celebrations in Hanover, but who cares about that? Now, what is going on? Well, it's a bit tricky. We don't have any letters between Fred and his parents, but we do have letters from Fred to his sister Anne. In these letters to Anne, Fred boo-hoo-hoos about old German George being dead. That proves that Fred was at least writing, and we know that Carolyn was a big letter writer, so either letters between Carolyn and Fred are inexplicably missing or no letters were written. If Fred was writing about how lovely old German George was, then perhaps Mum and Dad decided they didn't like him. It might be running in the family, this whole thing with dads not liking their lads. But I can't let the silly beheading go without giving you Lady Mary Wortley Montagu's description of Elizabeth Villiers. She is, if you recall, William III's mistress, that's right, William of Orange's mistress. Even though this description is terribly unkind, I've got to give it to you. A mixture of fat and wrinkles, and a considerable pair of bubbies, a good deal withered. A great belly that preceded her, the inimitable roll of her eyes and her grey hair, which by good fortune stood directly upright. Oh, dear me, that's a bit cruel, isn't it? So let's have another one from Lady Mary. This will be the little kiddie's former governess, instantly sacked by New George. She is Lady Portland, described at the coronation as very finely an Egyptian mummy embroidered over with hieroglyphics. There we go. Now, the new governess, we should tidy that up, was Mary Howard, former Maid of Honour, now Countess of Deloraine, and not noted for her intelligence. Old Paul called her a pretty idiot, with most of the vices of her own sex, and the additional one of ours, drinking. Oh, crikey, I'm turning this into the Gossip Magazine episode. Might be a good name for the episode. Maybe. George II will be like George I. That is, he's going to end up preferring Hanover. And, yeah, I know, Prince George was all about how marvellous England was and how fantastic the Poms are. But this is now King George. This guy is more like his dad than his princely self. What, say the Poms? We just voted in a huge amount of pocket money in the civil list, causing increased taxation on poor us. And all he cares about is Hanover. And look, he's henpecked. Yeah, more and more people are seeing that there's Queen Carolyn running the roost. You may strut, Dow George, but 'twill all be in vain. We know 'tis Queen Carolyn, not you, that reign. You govern no more than Don Philip of Spain. Then if you would have us fall down and adore you, lock up your fat spouse as your dad did before you. Oh, that's cruel, is it not? And that will come to the attention of the staff at St. James, who might be having a bit of a giggle and memorising it. That will then bring it to the attention of King George, who will go red and sputter in English and German, which makes him look as ridiculous as the satire can. He wants the author brought in on a charge of treason. Yeah, look, it was probably some anonymous schoolboy. Nobody will be found or charged. The question, though, might be, is the poem true? Well, it certainly looks like it. The newspapers have it as Carolyn being the queen and Walpole being a knight in a game of chess. Walpole can jump over the heads of nobles and is guarded by the queen. Between them, they can checkmate the king with ease. Now, George hasn't gone all out not wanting to look English, so Dad's old German retainers are no longer retained. Fair call, young George hardly knew the guy, thanks to his dad booting him out of St. James. Don't worry about these Germans, though. They'll pick up a job in a year or so. Carolyn is still playing the subservient role to George. If George walks into a room where Carolyn and Walpole are talking, she will immediately rise, curtsy, and say, "I shall withdraw to allow you to continue discussing your business without the distraction of a silly woman." Sometimes he'll let it go, and other times he'll let it stay, but it doesn't matter. Walpole and Carolyn, between them, can just manipulate him into whatever they want. Making it all worse is not only does George not know he's being manipulated, he boasts about how he rules. Here are some words from the wanker. George to courtiers. Charles I had been governed by his wife, Charles II by his mistresses, James II by his priests, and William III by his men. Worst of all, my father had been governed by anyone who could get at him. Then he asked his smirking audience, "And who do they say governs now?" Yeah, there'll be silence coming back at you, George. Nobody's going to tell you, mate. Carolyn was also making mistakes. She thought because it was easy peasy to manipulate George, she could manipulate anyone. But there were plenty of people who saw what she was doing and did the old reverse thingy. Being like she was with George, totally subservient and flattering. I hinted before that Carolyn was behind Henrietta's friends not getting jobs. Let's confirm it, and in fact Carolyn still sees Henrietta as a threat. I should say among others, and for Carolyn it's not just a matter of giving someone the boot. She wants to manipulate things so it isn't her doing the giving of the boot. Am I getting confusing? Let's have an example. Lord Chesterfield, gentleman of George's bedchamber and author of little ditties about Carolyn and so hated by Carolyn. He was a friend of Henrietta. One night he won a large sum of money, which of course he didn't want to take home at night time. He asked Henrietta if he could stash it in her apartments. "Sure," says Henrietta, but then of course he is spotted going into her chambers late at night by Carolyn. Carolyn will go straight off to George saying Henrietta is banging Chesterfield. Yeah, that seems extraordinarily unlikely. But then Chesterfield will be off to The Hague on diplomatic duties for 5 years. So if you see what I mean, my dear listener, Carolyn doesn't want to directly do things to people. She wants to manipulate it so bad things happen to them. A bit of King Crimson there with the track Exiles, because it just came into my head when I was talking about Chesterfield being, well, exiled. Carolyn will also start restricting George's visits to Henrietta. A few days might pass with no visit, and I'm pretty sure Henrietta would be quite pleased with that. The problem for Carolyn was that Henrietta gets visited by guys like Pulteney and Bolingbroke. They're the opposition to her and Walpole. George is starting to be short with Henrietta in public as well, and the gossip is out that he might be over her. About a year into his reign, George will really let rip at her in the gardens of St. James. Henrietta thought, well, that was it. She was gone, and so she wrote to George. I beg to know how soon it will be agreeable to you that I leave your family, or, with the utmost respect, permit me to say that from your Majesty's behaviour to me, it is impossible not to think my removal from your presence must be most agreeable to your inclinations. As I am very sensible that I am under your displeasure, so I am entirely ignorant in what manner I have incurred it. George, though, had calmed down, so she remained the official mistress to the king. She's been his mistress for about 10 years, and during that time he's had plenty of other women, but none lasting anything like 10 years. And he's also had plenty of these temper tantrums with Carolyn, and plenty of other people. I guess it's just who he is. He's a silly little man who has temper tantrums. Rumours are out, though, that Henrietta is out of favour and pretty much gone. So, great time for Charles Howard to strike. Charles is out of a job. Yeah, when German George died, that was it for Charles. His brother is still on to him for money that Charles owes him following a court settlement. And, of course, he's back into gambling and providing cash to sex workers. He thinks that Henrietta, now being mistress to a king, will be rolling in cash. His previous efforts to get money from her had been in writing, which totally failed because Henrietta was smarter than he was. He's also tried using the church, but that was also a dud. What can he do? Well, he can get pissed, then late at night go to St. James and yell loudly to wake everyone up. Then he can break into Carolyn's rooms, and Carolyn will be all,
"What the fuck? What the fuck?"
Charles will say he's there because he wants his wife back, and if you don't hand her over, then I'll get her next time she ventures out in your coach. Now, Carolyn will later report that she was terrified but did not show it. She told him that it was all up to Henrietta. Carolyn wouldn't force her out if she didn't want to go. Charles will say, "Okay, I'll talk to George." Carolyn will say, "Well, don't bother, because Henrietta is my woman of the bedchamber, so he's got no concerns about my staff." Finally, the guards get in and give Charles the boot. Henrietta, of course, will be very unhappy by this turn of events. She is insecure in her position at court and thinks this might be the last straw for George. Henrietta will forget her usual discretion and pour her heart out in writing to Alexander Pope. Now, what can he do? Well, he can write a sympathetic letter back, and then the headaches will worsen for Henrietta. She'll be out of action for a while, and even when she returns to work, it will be with the headaches. Chesterfield will write witty letters to try and cheer her up. No quotes from me, because I can't find the humour in it. I don't think he's very clever, this guy. All very miserable times for Henrietta, that's the point. Charles is making threats, George is impatient with her, and Carolyn is manipulating her. Her house is empty and unfinished, and she doesn't have the cash to finish it. Even if she could finish it, there'd be no point in her moving in. Charles would just come and kidnap her. Charles kept coming in, but the guards kept him away from Henrietta, so it was poison pen letters. He would also get guys to come in with verbal messages. The guards have got no idea that these guys are from Charles, so they just say, "Oh yeah, you can come on in. Here's a guy to say Charles wants you to pay £1,200 he owes his brother, so give me your answer now." "Oh, nothing to do with me," says Henrietta. "It's a matter between two brothers." "Too bad," says the messengers, "you need to pay. Now, you also owe Charles £4,000 in inheritance for your son, and he wants that now." "No way," says Henrietta. "I was starving when I was with Charles, and I'm not going to be starving now I'm not with him." The messenger will say, "Charles doesn't make above £400 a year." Henrietta will say, "When I was with him, I couldn't raise 400 pennies a year." Now, poor Henrietta is back at rock bottom, and it just keeps on happening, does it not? She will now think the unthinkable. divorce. Oh no, she wants to dissolve the indissolvable knot. Those who God has joined together, that, oh yeah, that bullshit. A woman who wants to terminate a marriage is ungrateful. Not my attitude, my dear listener. It's the attitude of the time. And of course, we men who run the show know what causes the problem. We allow those women too many liberties. Direct quote there, because our women implies ownership. We are in the time of perhaps first feminist, Mary Astle, who points out wives might be made prisoners for life at the discretion of their domestic governors, to which men say, she is a blasphemous troublemaker. She's had too much book learning and too little discipline. There is something worse than a feminist, though, my dear listener, and that is a feminist with a penis. Yeah, those guys can expect a hard time. Daniel Defoe was one. The case of women in England is truly deplorable, and there is scarce a good husband now to 20 that merited that name in former times, nor was beating of wives ever so much the usage in England as it is now. Yeah, so firstly, he's doing that standard appeal to the good old days, the golden age, make husbands great again. Secondly, he's on about domestic violence, so let's check out what the law has to say about that. If the wife be injured in her person or her property, she can bring no action for redress without her husband's concurrence, and in his name as well as her own. Well, good luck with that bit of justice, ladies. A reminder from the Love and Marriage episode that divorce may happen. Very rare, it requires an act of Parliament. Shame Henrietta backs the opposition and not Walpole. Over a couple of hundred years, only 4 divorces will be obtained by the woman. Each of these was very expensive and perhaps rather traumatic for those 4 women who were disgraced. Annulments are only really for royal and senior nobles. You can try for a legal separation through the churchy courts, but you have to prove your man is banging around and that your life is at risk. A less problematic method was a private deed of separation. You get your lawyer to draw up a document, but once again, there's a ton of downside for women. Men get custody of the kiddies, no ifs, no buts. Women forfeit their income from real estate now and in the future. And all her personal property goes to the man. Does that sound like a decent deal? No, it doesn't, does it? Henrietta will instruct her man, James Wellwood, to begin proceedings. It's a tough gig. He can have Henrietta's testimony, but he needs independent witnesses. The Howards have been separated for a long time. And early in the marriage, Henrietta had been ashamed at Charles's behaviour, so she just tried to keep it all quiet. It's also the case that the idea of a marriage termination is considered to be so vile that most people will say, look, I just don't want anything to do with it. Don't come to me for testimony. I want nothing to do with it. Mrs. Anne Hall and Mrs. Anne Selvo will be happy to testify that Charles is a total arsehole. Violent, cruel, frequently pissed, with lots of Henrietta boo-hoo-hooing and Charles wasting money on his sordid habits while Henrietta is left to suffer. And she's such an angel, obliging, courteous and obedient, never ever provoking such wicked treatment from Charles. Great stuff, says Henrietta's lawyer, who will promptly drop dead. Oh, bugger. Plenty more fish in the ocean, I hear you say. Sure, but Henrietta actually had a ton of confidence in our recently departed James Wellwood. So the next guy will be Thomas Baron Trevor. He was Lord Privy Seal and a big name in the legal world. He was a distant relative, so we'll put in the hard yards, but Henrietta, it seems, was not so confident in Tom. She will convince Tom to go to Carolyn to ask for £1,200 to go to Charles in order to retain Henrietta's services. Yeah, looking to pay off Charles, I don't know about that, Henrietta. Doesn't matter, Carolyn will say I haven't got the cash, so while I'd like to keep Henrietta on, £1,200 is too much. Besides, it's bad enough that I keep the king's loose floozies here without me paying for them too. Henrietta, then we'll go directly to George herself, and hey presto, here's a magical £1,200 that fell out of the sky for dead shit Charles, plus an annuity of £1,200 a year. Henrietta knows, though, that it won't be a permanent solution to the problem, so she'll get the Duke of Argyll to take up the case. Handily, Wellwood had left lots of handy notes to use. A document will be drawn up and sent to Charles's lawyers, and he will agree to the lot, except one part that left the door open for a proper divorce. It will be amended to say, except for his consenting or agreeing to a divorce, but then he signs it, and the marriage is finally over after 22 years to the day. Well done, Henrietta. Just a little bit there from this week's historical fiction, a movie called Chevalier. Now, this is based on an actual guy in the 18th century in France, just prior to the revolution there. This guy was a black guy, and it would appear that he was a musical genius. But he's black, so of course, it's not going to go well. The movie then is a bit of a slow motion train wreck for you to watch and be frustrated about. Well, it's turned into a bit of a downer, but it's a very visually pleasing movie. The acting's great. It's worth your while. Chevalier. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And it never fails to appeal to me. When we get somebody young who whacks out some grungy type song against the system or against society or against whatever. So how about we go out with the musician is named TX2. I'm not sure how you pronounce TX2. I guess you pronounce it TX2. And the song is Randy McNally, which is a US politician. So Randy McNally, No Love Like Christian Hate. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
From the flag of the USA. You're too fucking old. You do as you're told. You base your life off your nation's scroll. Out there burning witches, filling up the ditches. Tell me, can I still be saved? There's no love like Christian hate. Let's all